This is Jeff Blankfort with the March 27th edition of Takes on the World, a program in international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phone to get your takes on the world. While Rachel Maddow and congressional Democrats are still in a state of shock over the failure of their hero, Robert Mueller, to deliver Donald Trump's head on a platter, the president's White House has not let up in its efforts to bring down the governments of Iran and Venezuela. Overthrowing governments that Washington doesn't like is, after all, a national pastime that goes back to the earliest days of baseball. Today, about 20 minutes past the hour, I'm going to be speaking with Professor Lee Arts of Purdue University Northwest's Global Media Studies Department about the latest moves by the U.S. to remove Venezuela's elected president, Nicolas Maduro, from office and replace him with an American-trained telegenic stooge, Juan Guaido, who, without being elected, is recognized as the country's president by the U.S. and 50 other countries. One of those countries, it should be noted, is one of its immediate neighbors, Brazil. On Monday, Brazil's recently elected president, Jair Bolsonaro, called on his Ministry of Defense to carry out, quote, due commemorations, end quote, of the 55th anniversary of the military coup that took place on March 31, 1964. On that day, with the backing of the U.S., Brazil's president, João Goulart, was overthrown by the heads of the army, which imposed a military dictatorship in Brazil that lasted until 1985. However, the Ministry of Defense's spokesman, General Otávio Regio Barros, stressed that the Brazilian president does not consider the 1964 episode as a military coup, but instead thinks that, quote, the society, perceiving the danger that the country was living in at the time, joined civilians and the military, end quote, to recover and reunite Brazil. If all that had not happened, said General Barros, we would be having some kind of government here today that would not be good for anyone, end quote. It remains to be seen who the new Brazilian government will be good for, but it has been welcomed by President Trump and his executive branch henchmen Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. Last Tuesday, Trump hosted Bolsonaro in the White House, and New York Times writer Michael Shear and Maggie Haberman described the two as meeting their mirror images. Like other authoritarian leaders, Mr. Trump has embraced since taking office, they wrote, Mr. Bolsonaro is an echo of the American president, a brash nationalist whose populist appeal comes partly from his use of Twitter and his history of making crude statements about women, gay people, and indigenous groups. They say he's the Donald Trump of South America, Mr. Trump marveled during a speech to the Farm Bureau in January, noting that Mr. Bolsonaro had been called the Trump of the tropics since taking office this year. Do you believe that, said Trump? And he's happy with that, said the president. If he wasn't, I wouldn't like the country so much, but I like him. Meanwhile, back in Venezuela, Caracas and outlying provinces suffered another power outage on Monday. Was it an example of government incompetence or further evidence of U.S. efforts to destabilize the country and empower and enlarge the rank of its opponents? A memo from September 2010 by a U.S.-funded soft power organization that helped train Venezuelan coup leader Juan Guaido and his allies consider the potential collapse of the country's electric sector as, quote, a watershed event that, quote, would likely have the impact of galvanizing public unrest in a way that no opposition group could ever hope to generate, end quote. It was produced by the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, called Canvas, notes investigative journalist Max Blumenthal. It's a Belgrade-based democracy promotion, end quote, organization funded by the U.S. government that has trained thousands of U.S.-aligned youth activists in countries where the West seeks regime change. The group reportedly hosted Guaido and the key leaders of his Popular Will Party for a series of training sessions, fashioning them into a Generation 2007, determined to foment resistance to then-President Hugo Chavez and sabotage his plans to implement, quote, 21st-century socialism in Venezuela. Fast forward to noon of March 7th, when during a hearing on Venezuela at the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee, Senator Marco Rubio explicitly called for the U.S. to stir, quote, widespread unrest, unquote, declaring that it, quote, needs to happen, quote, in order to achieve regime change. Venezuela is going to enter a period of suffering no nation in our hemisphere has confronted in modern history, Rubio proclaimed. And around 5 p.m., the Simón Bolívar hydroelectric plant experienced a total and still unexplained collapse. Residents of Caracas and throughout Venezuela were immediately plunged into darkness. At 5:18 p.m. that day, noted Max Blumenthal, a clearly excited Rubio took to Twitter to announce the blackout and claim that, quote, backup generators have failed. It was unclear how Rubio had obtained such specific information so soon after the outage had occurred. According to Jorge Rodriguez, the communications minister of Venezuela, local authorities did not know if backup generators had failed at the time of Rubio's tweet. Back in Caracas, Guaido immediately set out to exploit the situation, just as his canvas trainers had advised over 8 years before. Taking to Twitter just over an hour after Rubio, Guaido declared, quote, the light will return when the usurpation of Maduro ends, end quote. Like Pompeo, Blumenthal observed the self-declared president framed the blackouts as part of a regime change strategy, not an accident or error. You'll be hearing more about Venezuela 20 minutes past the hour when I speak with Professor Lee Arts. Trump, meanwhile, startled the world on Monday when, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at his side and a handful of American Jews whom he has appointed to run his Israel-Palestine policy standing behind him, he announced the U.S. would now formally recognize Israel's sovereignty over the occupied Golan Heights captured from Syria during the 67 war. Another Israeli Prime Minister, Menachem Begin, who gained notoriety as the head of the terrorist gang Irgun and his image on wanted-for-murder posters in Britain before Israel's establishment, had declared the Golan Heights to be part of Israel in 1981, stealing the headlines from Ronald Reagan's first trip to Israel for Europe from the front pages. For the past 52 years, Washington, like the rest of the world, had considered the Golan Heights to be illegally occupied, but like the rest of the world, it had done nothing more to end that occupation than it has done beyond talk to end the occupation of the Palestinian West Bank and Gaza, also captured in the 67 war. If you are among those who still believe that the Oslo Agreement was intended to end the latter occupation, history as well as the wording of the document would indicate otherwise. Trump's recognition of Israel's possession of the Golan is being seen both in Israel and the U.S. latest significant gift to the embattled Israeli prime minister, who, charged with multiple instances of corruption, is facing a difficult re-election challenge on April 9th from retired General Benny Gantz from the new Blue and White Party, who was in Washington this weekend to speak at AIPAC's annual policy conference, as was Netanyahu before he flew back to Israel. Following the wishes of Netanyahu and Jewish mega-billionaire Sheldon Adelson, Trump has successfully pulled the U.S. out of the nuclear deal with Iran and reinstituted the crippling economic sanctions on Tehran, recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital and moved the U.S. embassy there, canceled financial aid to the Palestinian Authority and withdrew U.S. funding from UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, which has been providing economic assistance to Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, and the occupied Palestinian territories since 1948, when the new state of Israel ethnically cleansed more than 750,000 Palestinians from their homes and villages. What Israel has done for the U.S. in return is a question no American official or media pundit dare ask. The answer would be nothing. That this has been the agenda of Trump and his inner circle and not the Pentagon and U.S. intelligence agencies is rarely recognized by the media, but there it was on the front page of the New York Times on March 20th, where, writing from Kuwait, reporters Edward Wong and Edward Schmidt acknowledged that Washington's attempt to isolate Iran, including by punishing Iraqi militias and politicians who are supported by Iranian officials, has deep tensions not only between Washington and Baghdad, but also within the Trump administration. According to their article, U.S. military and intelligence officials worry that the increasing pressure on Iraq risks infuriating its parliament, including politicians linked to Iran, which could limit the movement of the 5,200 U.S. troops based in Iraq. In other words, the U.S. military and our intel agencies do not see Iran in the same light as do Israel, its most loyal supporters in the U.S., and the Trump White House. This is critical since the latter's actions are pushing the U.S. toward another war in the Middle East, not in pursuit of America's global interest, whatever one might think of them, but those of Israel, which I and others have argued was the case with the war on Iraq. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, whose confrontational stand on Iran, the Times writers note, has already strained ties with European allies, is leading the push for Iraq to confront its fellow Shiite majority neighbor. He arrived in the Middle East on Tuesday to speak with officials in Kuwait, Israel, and Lebanon about containing Iran. Under plans recommended by Pompeo and White House officials, the State Department would designate Iran's Military Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization. It would be the first time the U.S. has designated a unit of another government's military as a terrorist group. American officials who disagree said it could put U.S. troops and intelligence officers at risk of similar actions by foreign governments. Other Iraqi Shiite militias would also be listed as foreign terrorist organizations, which would subject Iraqi officials who support them to new economic sanctions and travel restrictions. The plan was leaked to the New York Times by anonymous sources, but Pompeo confirmed that he was looking at various groups, including the Revolutionary Guards, after he was asked by the Times on the flight to Kuwait about the proposed designations. "There may well be other organizations that we designate," Pompeo said. The State Department, the Times noted, designated an Iraqi group as a terrorist organization this month, despite opposition from the Pentagon. Iraq's militias, some of which are trained by Iranians, operate with Baghdad's approval or financial support, and several are legitimate players in Iraqi politics. They are part of the Popular Mobilization Forces, composed of about 50 paramilitary groups that fought against the Islamic State and are paid by the Shia-dominated Iraqi government. The Times quoted Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi of Iraq as saying, quote, "The Americans can make the decisions they want, but what the Americans see is different than what we see. Our position on the Popular Mobilization Forces is very clear and well known," end quote. Iraqi leaders were already irate over the Trump administration's insistence that they comply with American sanctions imposed against Iran after Trump withdrew from a nuclear deal with Tehran. Tensions between Washington and Baghdad have only risen through the winter, noted the Times. In February, you may recall, Iraqi politicians bristled after Trump said American troops in Iraq would monitor and pressure Iran. Iraqi leaders have been resisting demands by Pompeo to stop buying energy from Iran, another issue in which Pentagon officials have sided with Baghdad. Iraq officials also remain unhappy by the closing of the United States consulate in Basra, the country's second largest city, where a temporary halt of electricity exports from Iran led to violent rioting last summer. As with Iraq, the pressure campaign has angered leaders in Lebanon, where Iran-backed Hezbollah is a major military force, holds parliamentary seats in alliance with the largest Christian party, and runs a health ministry. Pompeo has told Iraq's leaders that they must stop buying Iranian natural gas and electricity despite the lack of other affordable options. Last Tuesday, following urging by senior Pentagon officials, he agreed to extend a waiver of the sanctions allowing Iraq to buy electricity from Iran for an additional 90 days in the middle of Iraq's scorching summer. Last month, Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi said that Iraq would not comply with the sanctions, citing the 13 years of U.S.-backed U.N. sanctions against the government of Saddam Hussein that cost the lives of over 500,000 Iraqis. You might remember Madeleine Albright being asked about that, and she said it was worth it. Now, as then, most Americans don't seem to care, and it is not on the agenda of any of the Democratic Party presidential hopefuls thus far, nor is it likely to be. Where Iran was mentioned over and over was at AIPAC's annual policy conference that concluded yesterday. Yeah, you haven't heard about it. The conference only rated a brief, albeit rare, mention by Don Gagne in yesterday's All Things Considered, but it was the relations of Jews to Israel that was the focus, and the short clips of Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and Vice President Mike Pence spoke to that. What I would advise all of you to do, if your stomach can handle it, is go to AIPAC, AIPAC.org, and watch the speeches of Mike Pence, Hoyer, Pelosi, New York Senator Chuck Schumer, an interview with South Carolina's Lindsey Graham, to understand how right on the money Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar was when she criticized those politicians who have an allegiance to a foreign country, and how serious a problem that is for not just Americans, including Jews, but for all the people on the planet. For an entirely different perspective, and one that largely represents my views, I urge you to watch speeches from another conference that took place last Friday at the National Press Club in Washington that received no press coverage. Sponsored by the Washington Report and the Institute for Middle Eastern Policy, or IRMEP, whose director Grant Smith has been a frequent guest on this program, it was titled, quote, The Israel Lobby and American Policy. And you can find all the presentations, including Smith's, on YouTube as well as on C-SPAN. One last note. On my last program, I played a speech of Kamala Harris to AIPAC in 2017. This speech, like the rest of the Democratic presidential this year, like the rest of Democrat presidential hopefuls, and cognizant of the lack of support for Israel by the party's base, Harris decided not to attend the AIPAC conference. So AIPAC came to her. Several AIPAC officials from California came to her office, where she posed with them for photos, then tweeted her support for Israel. And AIPAC promptly took credit for her coming to the conference, saying, tweeting, we are delighted that as part of AIPAC policy conference, our leadership met Senator Kamala Harris, who reiterated her support for the importance of the U.S.-Israel relationship. Here's Harris's tweet. Great to meet today in my office with California AIPAC leaders to discuss the need for a strong U.S.-Israeli alliance, the right of Israel to defend itself, and my commitment to combat anti-Semitism in our country and around the world. That was Kamala Harris yesterday. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.